Hello and welcome to the Explanation Podcast. My name is Ian Stevens. I am a political scientist and an activist, and I run a YouTube channel called The Lucretia Report, which you can look up.
And I am Silvia Salazar, founder of Tono Latino. I love to talk about politics and tell you ways that you can get more involved without jumping out a window.
And today on the podcast, we're going to talk about the school-to-prison pipeline. Before we get started, though, if you want to follow the show, you can do that on Twitter at @explanation_pod, on Instagram at @TheExplanationPod, and on Facebook at @TheExplanationPodcast. You can also send us an email at info@explanationpod.com. And if you want to watch a video version of these, you can go to Sylvia and I's YouTube channels that are linked in the description. So today we're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline, and I want to start with just explaining what that is. And it's the idea that there are certain structures within the education system that funnel people towards the criminal justice system, that make certain people more likely to encounter the criminal justice system at some point in their life, and that these systems fall disproportionately on Black and brown kids, and especially Black boys. A lot of the data we're going to talk about today falls hardest on Black boys in particular, on boys in general, and then on Black boys especially, and also on Hispanic boys and Indigenous boys. And I think to understand this, one of the things we need to start with is the concept of indirect discrimination. A lot of people have an idea of racism and discrimination as being things that are explicit, things that are malevolent, things that are somebody saying, I want to do this because I hate Black people. The Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis kind of thing. That's the idea a lot of people have in their heads. But even things that are not explicitly racist, things that can be race neutral on the surface, if they're built on a foundation that is imbued with racism, with white supremacy, if they're built on a foundation where there are already these existing inequities, then race neutrality can sometimes mean that it just exacerbates those existing inequities. And that's the idea of indirect discrimination. A great example of this would be predictive policing. One thing a lot of police departments are doing to try to use their resources more effectively is they're using these models where they input data about crimes and arrests. And these models tell them what neighborhoods they should go to patrol in that have the most crime. But in America, as we talked about in a previous episode, the part of the city you live in and your race are often very much linked. And crime and poverty are often very much linked. So when you're putting in this data, you're putting in data largely about Black and brown communities, which sends more cops to Black and brown communities. And since more cops are present there, there are more people to see crimes happening, and more arrests are made in Black and brown communities, which drives these models to tell you you need even more cops, which means even more arrests are made, etc., etc. That's a good example of indirect discrimination. But what we're going to talk about today is another pretty good example of indirect discrimination, because all of the things that go into this, none of them say this is about race. They're all race neutral, but their effects end up disproportionately affecting certain races over others. So let's go back in time. The way that this all started, and one thing that's often cited as the origin of a lot of this, is the 1994 Gun-Free Schools Act. And a lot of people think this bill was passed in response to Columbine. It was actually passed several years before Columbine happened. But the 1990s were a period where a lot of people were very worried about crime and violence. The murder rates in the United States were very high. The violent crime rates in the United States were very high. And crime rates in general were very high. And a lot of people had signed on to what's become known as the broken windows theory of policing. What this is the idea that if you police small crimes, like broken windows, vandalism, graffiti, jaywalking, vagrancy, small crimes like that, if you police those harder, then that will deter larger crimes from happening. And one of the ways that was enacted was through this bill, the 1994 Gun-Free Schools Act, which mandated that schools introduce zero tolerance policies for kids who bring weapons to school, requiring that they automatically get whatever the highest punishment in that school district is. And that, on its surface, yeah, that makes sense. But because this idea of broken windows policing was already infused into the American political consciousness and into so many other things, it's like improv. They said yes, and they expanded on that. So pretty soon, these zero tolerance policies were not just for guns. They were for drugs, they were for fighting, and in some cases, even for lesser things like insubordination and such. We'll talk about that some more later. But it created this culture where people thought that by punishing kids very harshly, you would enforce stronger discipline. And so suspensions started to be used a lot more. We have more than double the number of suspensions happening now than in the 1970s. Expulsions began to be used a lot more. And law enforcement began to be used a lot more in schools. And that is basically the core of what's happened. So let's get into some of the explanations for why this is a thing. According to one study, 95% of suspensions in the United States are for minor offenses, like disrespect or tardiness, things that are often subjective. In California, the most common reason that kids get suspended is willful defiance, basically disrespect. And 40% of suspensions in New York are for insubordination, also basically disrespect. So a lot of these suspensions and expulsions also, but suspensions are the main tool that get used a lot more often than expulsions do. And the difference is, for anyone who's not familiar, expulsions are basically permanently getting kicked out of school. Suspensions are temporarily getting kicked out of school, either out of school or in a special segregated class in school, a disciplinary class. Most suspensions that happen in the United States are subjective for relatively minor offenses. And because they're subjective, because it's not about, oh, this kid brought a gun to school, this kid brought drugs to school as often, that allows for implicit biases to become stronger. That's the idea that black and brown kids are more likely to get in trouble for these subjective offenses. And when they get in trouble for these subjective offenses, they're more likely to get in more trouble.
That's what I was gonna say. It sounds like it's something that would be relative to the teacher's perception of something that happened versus a very clear rule that says you did this. Like you, I don't know, in me growing up, you were not allowed to dye your hair any color that was not, you know, natural hair color, or you would get suspended. So that's a very clear thing of like, you either have purple hair or you don't have purple hair. But disrespect, it's very much like you might have perceived it as disrespectful. Maybe it was a little off tone, but it's just not a very binary situation, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of room for interpretation. Like, exactly. Where's the line at which point it becomes disrespect?
Yeah.
And even the same thing could be interpreted by different people in different ways. Or depending on what your existing perception of the kid is, you can interpret the same thing in different ways. Like, if there's a kid that you have always had a great relationship with, who has always been a good kid, they can probably get away with a lot more than a kid who's already on thin ice, right?
Yeah.
So one of the seminal works on school discipline is a multi-year study of over a million kids that tracked over a million kids for several years. That was done by the Council of State Governments Justice Center and the Public Policy Research Institute. And I'm going to cite that study a lot because it found a ton of data, as you would expect from tracking over a million kids over the course of several years. And it's some of the best data that we have about school discipline. It found that on the first offense, Hispanic kids were twice as likely to get suspended as white kids were, and black kids were three times more likely to get suspended.
Wow.
So the first time you're referred to the principal's office or to administration or whatever the equivalent of that in your school is, if, for example, say white kids have a 20% chance of getting suspended on that very first time, Hispanic kids have a 40% chance of it, and black kids have a 60% chance of it. And that's despite the fact that for all three groups, over 90% of those referrals to administration were for code of conduct violations, which means it's not something like fighting or guns or drugs. It's usually for these kind of offenses we've been talking about.
I'm guessing that the proportion of teachers is also heavily white and not Hispanic and black, because I'm guessing culturally a Hispanic teacher would be able to interpret something coming from a Hispanic student as something, a response, not as disrespectful, but maybe as just a, you know, a normal exchange culturally. What do you think about that?
So teachers are more likely to be white in the United States, including in majority minority neighborhoods or neighborhoods that have larger proportions of minority students. Teachers are more likely than the general population to be white. We do have some data, though, that would suggest that these kinds of biases are universal. Which makes sense to me. Even Hispanic and black people and indigenous people are still living in a society where they have, generally speaking, the same education, the same media, they have the same things being put into their head. And so we have some indications that even people of color have these same biases against other people of color, where they're more likely to trust white people, they're more likely to think that white people are behaving better, to give white people the benefit of the doubt. Is that something you think you've experienced? Do you think you could speak on that?
Well, I didn't go to school here, but I do think that there's ways that we Latinos express ourselves that somebody else could interpret as rude and disrespectful, but to us, it's not. We tend to be more, I don't know the words to describe, like more loud and I don't know, we make more noise, and that's just part of who we are. I don't know. Or even how we like could greet each other or things like that. Somebody else could interpret that as, oh, she was being rude to somebody else. I don't know. I think there's a cultural nuance there that other people could miss, especially if they're not familiar with that race or ethnicity. I just think that there's definitely something there that is very subjective, like you said, and it's very much up for interpretation. And we know that there are a lot of implicit biases there that also factor into this entire process of the authority figure interpreting something as rude or disrespectful when that was not the intent. Or, like you pointed out, there's kids that are already on thin ice, and it's just, I mean, even as a mother, it's my own child. This is not even a different race, ethnicity, background, nothing. Like, she literally shares 50% of my DNA. And when on those days that I'm losing my patience, then she'll do like one tiny little thing, but I'm already like almost over the top. And that's the, what's that expression in English? The camel broke, whatever.
The straw that broke the camel's
Yeah.
back.
So it's like, it just, she does this one little thing and I blow up. And it has nothing to do with who she is, what color she is, where, like, what language she speaks at home. No.
I think sometimes we forget what it was like to be children, and I guess, in a way, children operate totally differently than adults. Children think differently than adults. Children behave differently than adults. And even within the same groups, they're of a different generation than us. They have different experiences. And sometimes we forget the way children think sometimes, I think. I do want to give a little disclaimer because I'm going to mostly reference data relating to white kids, black kids, and Hispanic kids in this. And that's what most of the data we have is. There's not that much data out there regarding Asian kids or indigenous kids, and I think that's largely because black and Hispanic and white kids are such a much larger groups. There are a lot more black kids than there are indigenous kids, for instance, and a lot more Hispanic kids. But we do have some indications that a lot of these issues play themselves out for indigenous kids also, and also that indigenous kids are very likely to be perceived as disrespectful, as being insubordinate. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And Candace, right before we were doing this, I was editing the interview of Candace, so I know we bring this up, but I do want to give that disclaimer that there's not as much data out there about those, so we're mostly going to talk about Hispanic and black kids. I do feel like a lot of people will probably listen to this and they might think, okay, how do you know that that is bias? How do you know that there's not some individualized thing in each case that it makes sense that people are getting stricter punishments? And we can't know about every single case, but we do have a lot of data to suggest that there is implicit bias happening. One study that I came across that I thought was very interesting was conducted at Yale University by their child psychology research center or something like that, but it's the part of Yale University that studies childhood behaviors and stuff. It's their department. And it was done in 2016, and it had two halves. In the first half, 130 teachers were told to watch this video of these four preschool students and look for misbehavior. And in the second half, they were told to read a vignette and suggest what punishment the kid who misbehaved in the vignette should get. The two kids in the vignette who misbehaved, my bad. And what they didn't realize was that in the first half of the experiment, they were actually tracking not misbehavior. There was no obvious misbehavior happening in the videos. I guess that's subjective, but nothing that was intentionally, this is supposed to be misbehavior. They were actually tracking where the teachers were looking. They had software set up where it could track their eyes and it could track which kids they were looking at the longest. And the four kids in this video were a black boy, a black girl, a white boy, and a white girl. And they found that teachers, in order from most time to least time, spent the most time looking at the black boy, and then the white boy, and then the black girl, and then the white girl. So boys got more attention than girls, and black kids got more attention than white kids. But the difference between first and second place, like the black boy got far more attention from most of the teachers. And that's very similar to what we were talking about the police from earlier. If there are more police in your neighborhood, they're more likely to catch the crimes that do happen. It doesn't mean crimes aren't happening in other neighborhoods. It means there aren't police there to catch it. If you're spending the most time looking at the black kids and the boys and the indigenous kids and the Hispanic kids, you're going to find more misbehavior. And that also implies that these teachers had an implicit bias, that they were predisposed to expect more misbehavior from the black kids, because remember, they were told that they were looking for misbehavior. They were expecting they were going to find misbehavior. In the second half of the experiment, where they read a vignette about students misbehaving and were asked to choose a punishment, of the 130 teachers, 65 of them were given one version of the vignette, and 65 of them were given another version. And the text was exactly the same, except for in one version, the vignette, the students were named Jake and Emily, stereotypical white names, and in the other version, they were named Latoya and Deshaun, stereotypically black names. And they found that the teachers were more likely to give Latoya and Deshaun harsher punishments than they were to give Jake and Emily harsher punishments, and they were more likely to recommend suspensions for Latoya and Deshaun.
Wow.
Yeah, and something I thought was very interesting, and this goes into what I was saying earlier, is that this was not just white teachers that were more likely to look at the black kid in the first half and more likely to give...
Okay, that was my next question. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just white teachers that were more likely to look at the black kid in the first half and to punish Latoya and Deshaun harder in the second half. In fact, in the second half of the vignette where they were choosing punishments for the kids, sorry, in the second half of the experiment where they were choosing punishments for these hypothetical kids, they found that black teachers were even more likely to give LaToya and Deshaun harsher punishments than white teachers
were. Okay, hold on. But comparing the punishment by a black teacher, would they recommend harsh punishment? Would they also recommend a harsher punishment for the white kids versus the white teachers? Because I think culturally, here's the thing. You know, well, I'm not a black mother. So let's just talk about Latino mothers. We tend to punish harsher than white moms. So maybe, I'm just guessing here, the black teacher just tends to give harsher punishment to all the students, not just because they're black. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't have that in front of me, whether Jake and Emily got harsher punishments from black teachers than they did from white teachers. But at least LaToya and Deshaun got harsher punishments than Jake and Emily did when the black teachers, like the black teachers judging LaToya and Deshaun, gave them harsher punishments than the black teachers judging Jake and Emily. So at the least, there is still bias happening. Whether or not that bias is stronger than in the white teachers, you make a good point that we don't necessarily know without having the full data set in front of me.
I just had a RA in college that always said that if you had two kids, and one was a white kid and the other one was a Latino kid, and their moms are scolding them for the exact same thing that they did, you always think that the Latino kid did something way worse just because of the way we scold our kids. And I would agree. Like, you see, I don't know, white moms are so sweet when they scold their children. They're like, oh, honey, you did this wrong. And we're like, ¿cómo se le ocurre hacer eso? Blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've definitely heard that before. I've only had a white mother, so I can't personally speak to that. But I've definitely heard of that being an occurrence.
Yeah, I had a very angry mother. I mean, even her Latina friends would ask her to scold their children. So,
like, that almost sounds like renting, like,
yeah,
rental scolding.
Yeah, something like that.
Contract scolding. But at the very least, it does show that implicit bias exists within the teachers, whether they're white teachers or black teachers. And I don't want to make this out to sound like, oh, teachers are bad. No, teachers are not bad. Teachers are good, generally speaking. But everyone, every single person has an implicit bias. That's why I always say that unbiased media does not exist, and it's unproductive to pretend that it exists, and that pretending that unbiased media exists just leads to more problems, which I could get into it, but that's not what we're talking
about
today.
That's a whole other episode.
Yeah, that's a whole other topic. But every single person has biases from your experiences, from the things that have been taught to you, from what your parents taught you, from what media taught you, from what the society around you taught you, and from what you've been through in your personal life. And we don't leave those at the door when we go into any job, including teaching. Most people are probably not even aware of it. I don't think that teachers are going in there and saying, I want to pick on the black kids. I definitely think it would be ridiculous to think that the black teachers are going in there and thinking, I want to pick on the black kids. I think that it's just something that is within us, whether we realize it or not. And I heard someone say something the other day that you should be wary of the person who tells you they don't have a bias, and be more confident with the person who tells you that they recognize their bias and they're working to overcome it. There was a great quote by the person who ran this experiment at Yale, and the quote was, implicit bias is like wind. You can't see it, but you can sure see its effects. Because when in practice this kind of bias gets applied to the school system and discipline and suspensions, that's why you get instances like black kids being 3 times more likely and Hispanic kids being 2 times more likely to be suspended on their first instance of referral to administration. So why is this a part of the school to prison pipeline? Why is this not just a bad thing that happens within schools? Why does it affect the criminal justice system? One of the reasons is because getting suspended from school makes you more likely to drop out, or even getting disciplined in general makes you more likely to drop out of school, but getting suspended is especially bad. And expelled, of course, is even worse, but that's much rarer than being suspended. That study that we talked about earlier, the one that tracked over a million kids, it found that with one instance of discipline, and they were counting suspensions, expulsions, and arrests as discipline, with one instance of discipline, your chance of dropping out of school doubled compared to kids that had zero. And it went up with each subsequent instance of discipline. So if you had been disciplined three times, you were even more likely to drop out of school. Four times, you were even more likely to drop out of school. Who drops out of school is a pretty good indicator of who will end up in contact with the criminal justice system. People who drop out of school are far more likely to be arrested, and a far larger portion of people who are in prison don't have a high school diploma or GED equivalent. One of the reasons for that is because you have a hard time finding a job. If you have a hard time finding a job, you end up being more impoverished, you have a hard time finding housing. All of these things that play into criminality, which is like a whole big topic in itself. But it creates circumstances where you are more predisposed to commit crimes because of your economic situation. And even if kids don't drop out of school, if they are being suspended, they are falling behind in school. They're losing the structure and stability that school provides. They're losing opportunities to socialize into societally acceptable forms of behavior, especially if this is happening when they're young and they're still developing into the people they're going to be. They're still developing how to behave in society and not get in trouble, hopefully.
Plus, what are they supposed to do while they're suspended? It's, what is that saying? The devil and the idle hands, whatever.
Idle hands
are the devil's
this
work.
From the Bible, right? Idle hands are the devil's work or something.
I don't know if it's from the Bible,
like,
but
that.
It's a very common expression. Like, if you have nothing to do, then you're more likely to find trouble.
And what often happens is that when they get suspended, it's just you decide what you do. You know, a lot of times the parents have to work during the day, especially because low-income kids are more likely to get suspended. Parents are often at work and they do whatever. And that's actually another one of the issues, is because when they're suspended, they're now socializing with only other kids who have been suspended, or oftentimes adults. And they are oftentimes socializing with, they're not socializing with kids who aren't in trouble. And so that creates this
bad influence.
Yeah, in groups that are feeding off of each other, and it's like exacerbating the same issues. It's not fixing their issues, their issues are getting worse. Then when they go back to school, they are stigmatized, which causes them to socialize even more with these same groups. And if they're getting suspended for minor stuff, if they're getting suspended arbitrarily or they're getting punished arbitrarily, and especially if they view it as unfair, that can cause them to lose trust in authority, which can cause more misbehavior, cause them to act out more, and when they're adults, can cause them to trust institutions of authority like police and government and such, bosses and things like that, less, and is also correlated with who commits crimes, who ends up going to jail. And so all of these things come together to make kids who get disciplined and kids who get suspended much more likely to end up in the criminal justice system. Another thing that we could not have this conversation without talking about is school resource officers, SROs. And these are the police officers that work in a lot of schools. 48% of schools have an SRO. I had one in high school. I didn't have one in elementary school, though a lot of elementary schools do. And the idea behind these was to stop school shootings and violence at schools. These first got really popular after Columbine, when people first started to be afraid of school shootings, and obviously that's even a much bigger fear now, when it's much more common than it was in the 90s and early 2000s after Columbine. But they haven't been very good at that. A great example of it is Parkland. There was a cop at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, one of these school resource officers, who failed to stop the shooting. And in fact, there was an officer at Columbine who failed to stop the shooting. And so these cops have not been very good at stopping school shootings. What they have been good at is arresting kids who would otherwise be suspended usually. It almost cuts out the middleman. It cuts out the pipeline and just makes it the school to prison almost. Where administrators get this attitude like, oh, well, as long as they're here, we might as well use them. And offenses that would, without an SRO, end up with suspensions or other forms of discipline, end up with arrests. You can go onto YouTube, type kid getting arrested, child arrested at school. There will be all kinds of videos of little kids, high school kids, middle school kids getting arrested for very minor things sometimes. When I made my YouTube video about this topic, for dramatic effect, I started with a montage of kids getting arrested in school and cops in schools misbehaving. And some of these, you hear the stories and it's like, oh, this kid is 5 year old, was laying on the ground kicking and screaming, and then they kicked a teacher or something and they got arrested for assault. And it's like, okay, well, that sounds like if the cop was not there, that would just be a temper tantrum. That would just be a 5 year old having an episode. And so there's a lot of data to show that schools that have a school resource officer get a lot more arrests, and that these school resource officers are disproportionately located in low-income schools, which is often code for black and brown schools. And that same effect I talked about earlier when we talked about police getting sent to different neighborhoods, and when I talked about the teachers paying more attention to black kids. If there are more cops in more black and brown schools, it means more black and brown kids are more likely to get arrested. That seems intuitive, right? That gets even worse when you find out that 74% of arrests made by school resource officers are for disorderly conduct. Things like what I described, a kid having a temper tantrum. I'm going to describe in our interview one that happened in Arizona where a kid got arrested essentially for breaking the dress code and then refusing to follow a cop's orders. Most of these arrests, 74% of these arrests, are not for assault, they're not for weapons, they're not for drugs, they're not for stealing, they're for basically kids being kids and teenagers being teenagers. Things that without a cop would not result in an arrest unless there was a cop in the building to do it. And so black and brown kids are getting arrested more, and black and brown kids are getting suspended more, and they're dropping out of school more, which is causing them to get arrested more as adults, which is yet another way that the disparity between white people in America and black and brown people in America is exacerbated. So a lot of schools have been trying to work to overcome this. Broken windows policing has become more controversial, has become less automatically accepted like it used to be. And a lot of schools are coming to recognize that this is a negative cycle. And the most effective ways to do this are basically by removing school resource officers from schools, which I know that a lot of parents are wary about because school shootings are a scary and real possibility, but like we talked about, they have a terrible record of stopping school shootings. They have not been able to do that very effectively thus far. And they mostly just arrest kids for things that they probably shouldn't be arrested for. And the other way that schools have been able to make a substantive difference in this is by just having less harsh punishments. They've revised their policies so that fewer things get suspensions, so that you can't give a suspension on a first offense unless it's for drugs or weapons, that you can't give a suspension for insubordination or for disrespect or things like this. They've revised their policies in such a way that suspensions and expulsions are less used. And a lot of school districts have seen serious success with that. One thing that I am skeptical of is the idea that implicit bias classes for teachers, for administrators, are going to be a very effective policy. I think that in almost every industry and every aspect where that's been the only thing that people try, that's been completely ineffective because you can't wipe out a lifetime of implicit bias with a 2-hour class, especially when people don't even realize that they have implicit bias.
I agree completely.
And so I'm not saying that it's bad to have trainings like that, but I think that a lot of people try to look at it as the only thing you need to do. They say, oh, we have this implicit bias training. They've done this for cops. They do this in workplaces. We have this implicit bias training. And now we're good. No, you're not good. That alone is
not. It becomes a check mark on a list of to-do things to be compliant with.
Exactly.
What's expected, and it doesn't create change.
And I'll tell you, when I was working in retail and we had these standardized training courses, some of them were for things like bias and to, you know, getting along, you know, diversity training and all that. People often don't even pay attention to that. I think it's just like with police that, sure, implicit bias classes and diversity training, that's fine. But if that's the only thing you're doing, that's not going to work and you need real substantive reforms. What do you think is a good way for school districts to handle this, Sylvia?
Well, for starters, they can start by removing these SROs, because that's not working. Having very clear-cut definition. I see, I grew up in a different country, and suspensions were, I'm not going to say like super common, but it did happen. But it didn't create all of the things that happened here, to be honest with you. So it's been interesting to learn how things are handled here. And it's insane to think that, to see that children are being arrested and put into a system for behaving inappropriately in a school. They clearly need a better support system. They need adults to handle the situation differently. And it just dawned on me that it's very similar to a lot of the cases that we're seeing of police brutality, where ideally you would call another unit that is capable of handling a situation with somebody that's having, you know, like a mental breakdown or behaving in a way that is troublesome, instead of having to call the police when the police are not trained to handle something like this. I'm forgetting his name right now, but the incident that comes to mind is of that black man who I think had a mental illness, and his own family called the police and said, hey, my brother just left the house. I think he's maybe schizophrenic. I don't remember the specifics of that particular case, but the police killed him, when ideally you would have been able to call a unit of experts in mental health that could get him and take him to a mental hospital to get the help that he needed. And instead, it was handled by cops that just used brute force and murdered him.
One thing I think we should keep in mind regarding SROs is that these are, you know, they call them school resource officers, but they are just police officers. They're just normal police officers. And police officers are trained, like, they're trained with the idea that the main, the main adversary you're going to be facing is an adult. And usually departments train police officers to assume that their adversaries are going to be like well-armed criminal mastermind adults. And you take that kind of attitude, that kind of training, and you put it into a situation where you're dealing with 5-year-olds, and it's not going to work out well.
And again, even as a mother, I lose my patience with my own kid. I am in constant admiration of teachers, how they can handle so many kids and so much energy and noise and still keep their calm. And they are able to handle situations in a lot calmer ways than I would. Like, I would lose my patience a lot faster than a teacher, even with my own child. Again, because I'm not trained to deal with multiple children. And I'm guessing this officer isn't either.
It makes me think of something I've been saying for a while, which is the distinction between soldiers and police officers. They're supposed to have very different missions. The objective of a soldier is to destroy the enemy. Your training is to go and fight other soldiers to the death. Only one of you is going to come out alive. Only one side is going to come out victorious. And your goal is to destroy the other side. That's not supposed to be the goal of police. The goal of police is not supposed to be to destroy the other side. But more and more often, I think police are getting... We're treating police like they're soldiers. Especially after 9/11, once they got a bunch of anti-terror responsibilities, and there were a lot more veterans, a lot of which became police officers, we've started to treat the police like a military force. And I don't think that we should consider police and the military to be the same thing, because they're supposed to have diametrically different roles. And when we treat them like the same thing, police start to take on the idea that they are soldiers and that their goal is to destroy the enemy. And I just think...
Well, their gear definitely looks like they're going to war.
Oftentimes, yeah. So I think the best thing we can do now is we can go and talk to Candace Valenzuela about this topic.
Yes, let's do it.
Candace Valenzuela is the daughter of a Mexican-American mother and a black father, and in 2020, she ran for Congress in Texas's 24th district. She was the first person in her family to get a college degree and became an educator, working as a special needs teacher, and then started her political career on the school board. While on the Carrollton Farmers Branch School Board, she worked to shut down the school-to-prison pipeline. Here, we're going to talk about her experience with bias in policing and the school-to-prison pipeline, what she did to break it down, and what lessons other schools can learn from that. Hi, Candace. Thank you for joining us. We're glad to have you here today.
Great to be here, Ian. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much to you too, Sylvia. I really appreciate it.
You're our first guest. I'm so excited.
It won't be the first guest release, but we're recording this one ahead of time for all the listeners. So the first thing I want to ask you, on your website from your campaign, you talk about how you have firsthand experience of the harm that overcriminalization of black and brown bodies can cause to individuals, families, and communities. So can you tell us a little bit about what your personal experience with that is?
Well, I am the sister of a black Latino man. I am the mother of two young sons, albeit two sons that are lighter than I am, but aren't going to escape the notice of folks that have identified them as others. And it's of great concern to me that folks understand that when we deal with police officers, we have the same expectations as everyone else. We have the same desires that everyone else has, which is to have a safe and secure home, to be able to walk into the streets and not feel as though we were going to be harmed or robbed. And to have the feeling that your police officers, the folks that you're paying the same tax dollars to, don't necessarily see you just another citizen, but see you as an inherent threat before you even open your mouth, is something that my family's experienced. A family member of mine was accused of child neglect. She was accused of leaving her kid alone at home for too long. And the police officer who came to investigate or to do the wellness check ended up tackling her to the ground and putting a foot on her neck in front of said child while that child was a toddler. And I'm also the daughter of a police officer, a black police officer. My father worked for the New Orleans PD for 20 years. And I understand the harrowing nature of being put out in the community in order to protect it. But he himself, experienced the racism, saw the racism that some of his colleagues had, and understood that there were parts of the system that as an individual you cannot touch. And that's why it falls on policymakers to set up systems of accountability, set up systems of oversight, set up these systems that everybody is on the same page on. The vast majority of folks want to see that criminals are prosecuted and are held accountable, and they want to know that their police officers are protecting everyone in equal measure. And what brought to the forefront when we saw George Floyd die on television screens, on computer screens, on cell phone screens across the country. There is no equity in policing until we fix this system. And I am proud to be doing the work to bring some of those subtleties to light.
And it's interesting to me that you say that you're... You said your uncle is a black police officer?
My father.
Your father.
My
Sorry.
Dad.
Your
yes.
dad.
How do you think he and other people of color in police would look at the situations within their own police departments? And do you think that people of color in police see it in the same way that a lot of activists outside of police departments look at the way police interact with people of color?
Well, I've also had the opportunity to talk to the Black Police Association of Dallas, and I got to speak with them very frankly because of the nature of my family. And I'm also from two military veteran parents. Both my mom and dad were in the Army. And as folks who are charged with protecting the community, but also understand a lot of the flaws in the system, they're walking a real fine line. So many of them want to see the kinds of reforms that activists are asking for when it comes to, you know, greater mental health services, when it comes to having more folks involved in the community, helping to do the jobs that they're not trained for, taking a lot of the burden off of them so that they could focus on really difficult problems that are in their purview. And it would be a lot better for police officers if there was a system of accountability in place, so that if they do see racism, if they do see an officer acting inappropriately with the folks that they are charged with protecting, that they can report those things without fear of retaliation. And I've got to tell you, officers across the country of any color, you know, when you're talking about all those good eggs, they still have to deal with the fear of retribution in so many of these situations. And it's a scary thing. You know, it's not just somebody not talking to you at work. Police officers have a lot of power within the community, and no one knows that better than another police officer. But at the same time, you know, a lot of the good folks that get in there, they want to protect the community. They want to make sure that families are safe. They want to be the safeguards for a lot of what we consider American prosperity. And it sometimes hurts for them to be lumped with these other folks, but it seems like it's a completely intractable problem because folks can't tell the difference one way or the other. It's very hard.
What you're describing brought back some of the research that Ian and I were doing related to the school-to-prison pipeline. And one of the articles that we read, for example, talked about the chief judge in juvenile court in Clayton County, Georgia, that was saying that all of these police officers doing other things that are not policing the right way, like it just what you said about the support of police for alternatives to policing and using more like community resources to address a lot of situations, back all of this regarding schools. And the topic that we really want to dive deep into with you on all of these schools with cops in them, and the fact that having police at schools arresting minors and putting them into the juvenile system, now you put the burden on the Justice Department to be prosecuting these kids instead of actually prosecuting real crimes. And I know that you, as a board member in Carlton, Texas, you did some work with the school board to shut down this school to prison pipeline. So I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what are some of the things that you did and what are some of the things that can be implemented in other areas of the country to improve this situation.
Absolutely. It's a multi-pronged effect or a multi-pronged strategy in order to deal with the school to prison pipeline, because there are so many factors that come into place in order to create it, in order to keep it in place. One of which is pushing for more people of color to be hired within our school system. And it was it seemed like a no-brainer, but we did a lot of work to do that. The other part of that was trauma-informed training for trauma-informed teaching. Because when you're talking about, in my community specifically, I will not speak for every community of color, but within my community, a lot of the folks that are in my school district are, it's a majority person of color district, it's a majority at-risk youth district. And so what comes with a lot of the poverty, what comes with a lot of the food insecurity, housing insecurity is a great deal of trauma. And being able to distinguish between acting up and acting out is a skill that people of every color need to acquire before dealing with kids. I say this as a parent because I don't always know how to deal with my kid all of the time. And he's perfectly okay. Both of them are perfectly okay. So dealing with kids who came to school, maybe they didn't get breakfast. They came to school, maybe their parents spent all night fighting because they didn't know if they were going to be able to pay the rent. And teachers have an outsized role in their lives. And they have to learn how to keep the classroom going while these kids have a million things going on in the back of their heads. And so trauma-informed teaching helps teachers to understand that maybe punishment is not going to be the first step, or escalation all the way to the top is not supposed to be the very first step. And it makes it a lot easier overall. Another thing that we ended up doing is our alternative school, the place where we send kids because they've done something that cannot be overlooked, something that is very, very harmful to themselves or harmful to other kids in the area. And again, this is in juvenile school. This is the alternative school within their district. They put a yoga class in at the very beginning of the day. There was one class completely devoted to the kids just reflecting on what it was that brought them into that school. And then every week, each of the kids would meet with a teacher that they loved from their home campus so that there was a link to go back so that when they stepped back onto campus, they're like, okay, this is my safe place. This is my safe person. This is who I can go to. And it was really wonderful. I think the biggest problem that alternative school had was that kids sometimes wanted to go back to it. But that kind of treatment and care and counseling and thinking of these children as children is just one of the hugest things that we have to do. Now, I know that security resource officers more often than not are more likely to arrest kids than to stop an active shooter. We see this time and again. And if you're talking about a school in Texas or the South, you know, removing police officers from the inside of the school, sometimes, and I'm going to be honest, it's a non-starter. You know, and I can understand that because I'm also a parent and I can see that folks would feel as though that a police officer would stop some of these things from occurring. But even though we couldn't remove SROs, we could make sure that our SROs were getting trained in, again, trauma, in it's, you know, dealing with special needs students and dealing with racial bias. And so we made sure that each of our SROs were aware of the fact that these were kids in our community. These weren't, you know, just criminals. And we did a lot of work with them to do that. And I know that Irving, Texas was particularly good about that, but that was only after the incident where a young man was arrested for bringing a clock to school. So there have been bumps along the way, but really proud of the work that the district has done with police in order to make sure that all of the kids were safe. But there's still problems. When you're talking about, let's say a student is caught with marijuana, right? They're caught with weed. If a teacher or a principal catches them, the kid gets in trouble. I think they're automatically put in an alternative school and they deal with them that way. But if a police officer catches them, they're automatically put into the judicial system. There is no negotiation about that because that is the law. And it just shows that there are just so many issues when police aren't necessarily made for a specific environment. Their training, the rules that they adhere to are not necessarily designed to work well with children. And so we have to figure out how to reimagine policing and laws so that it works in a school setting. A kid's life isn't completely over because they did one stupid thing one time. And that seems to be the case for kids who tend to be affluent. They can do several stupid things several times and still be okay over the course of their lifetimes. But folks who don't understand the legal system or folks who don't have the money to navigate the legal system are often going to find themselves in a position where their kids are not going to be able to even get a foothold in the job world later on. And it's by no fault of the police officer who may, and again, I've loved a lot of the police officers I worked with in the district, care about the kids. It no fault of, you know, a lot of the other folks in their lives. They just made a mistake. And we still have so much work to do, but I'm glad that we got the ball rolling on it.
Yeah, in that case that Sylvia was talking about in Clayton County, they were getting so overwhelmed that they didn't have enough time for the hearings from all the people, all the kids getting arrested at schools. And they actually struck a deal between the courts and the police and the school district that severely restricted what kinds of things the police could arrest minors at schools for. And it saw graduation rates raised by, I think, 53% in that county. So there were some great outcomes there. And a lot of schools are experimenting with things like what you talked about, trying to make punishments less severe and not jumping to suspensions. There were some numbers that came out in 2009 in a study published in the Journal of Criminal Justice. And these numbers are a little old, granted, but they found that 74% of arrests at schools with an SRO and 46% of arrests at schools without one were for disorderly conduct. That came out to about 8.5 arrests per 100 students at a school with an SRO, which seems pretty high to me. So could you tell us about what that looks like when you have a disorderly conduct arrest at a school and what kinds of circumstances usually make something like that happen?
I can tell you what it should be. What it should be is an arrest for a child bringing a weapon to school and putting people in harm's way. I can tell you how it sometimes turns out. And this wasn't an issue that I saw in my district because that is something that I would have something to say about. But it's an issue that I've seen in districts across the country. Disorderly conduct could be a kid being a kid. Maybe the kid doesn't want to sit in the right place. Maybe a kid mouths off to a teacher. Maybe a kid is wearing the wrong kind of pants that day and refuses to comply otherwise. There are a lot of ways in which kids can be disorderly, and you can see teachers going to the highest possible escalation because they feel as though this is the only way to handle these children. And again, this is one of the ways in which we've built and reinforced the school to prison pipeline. And it's harmful. And that comes to the fact that we have to be training these teachers, again, trauma-informed teaching. We also need to be talking about equity and biases with our teachers, because in a lot of these communities of color, you see a very large number of white teachers. And I want everyone to be a teacher if they want to be. But it may not necessarily be second nature to be able to understand what's going on with a lot of these kids who have very different life experiences. So having that training available to the teachers and making sure that we hire more teachers of color, hire more teachers from within those communities so that we can foster a better community that looks at child rearing, child teaching as that and not as escalating or ejecting a problem from a classroom, because these kids are kids.
I'm sorry, but if I'm hangry, I'm going to speak out. With my daughter, whenever she starts getting mouthy, the first thing I think about is, how long has it been since she either had something to eat, or how tired is she? What happened today that could make her a little tired? Because she's being not herself. And we, like you said it perfectly, Candace, like we, even as parents, sometimes don't know how to handle when our kids throw a tantrum. And it's us with maybe one or two kids or maybe more. And these officers, SROs, they don't know how to handle these kids. And all they do is like abuse their power and their position. Yelling at a kid that's already in a state is not going to solve the situation.
And that, as a parent, I have to remind myself of that all the time. And exactly. They're my kids. right?
Exactly.
That training is crucial. You're absolutely right, Sylvia.
Exactly.
Yeah, there was a case in Arizona where a high school kid was arrested because he wore a bandana on his head to school that was against the school dress code, and he wouldn't take it off when the school asked him to, and then when the police officer asked him to. And like, yeah, that seems like kind of a dumb thing to do, but also it doesn't seem like a major criminal offense. And there are countless videos out there of little kids, very little kids sometimes, getting arrested essentially for throwing tantrums. And it's very much playing into what you were talking about when a kid is caught with marijuana, that if it had not been for police presence or for school administrators calling the police sometimes, that would have been something that we just look at as a part of a kid being a kid or a teenager being a teenager. But with the police presence, it became something criminal.
Absolutely.
So another thing that gets brought up a lot as a cause of all of this is suspensions, which have more than doubled since the 1970s. They used to be very rare in previous decades. And one of the most, often the most common causes for these are tantamount to disrespect. In California in 2010, for instance, the most common reason for suspension was willful defiance. And in New York in 2013, it was insubordination. And these suspensions fall disproportionately on kids of color. Black boys especially, and then indigenous boys also, are far more likely than white boys or girls to get suspended. And that feels to me reminiscent of the kind of paternalistic ideas that have been used to maintain white supremacy in the past. And the idea that black people are quote-unquote disrespectful has been harnessed very malevolently in the past. There have even been cases in previous decades when there were lynchings for people being quote-unquote disrespectful to white people. And I know teachers aren't going into the classroom and like thinking consciously, all right, I'm going to try to pick on the black kids, but people harbor biases that are built into us culturally and are very deep within you. And they've done studies that have shown that teachers harbor these biases just as much as anyone else. So whether it's conscious or unconscious, how much do you think that these kinds of tropes and the cultural ideas of how black and white people are supposed to behave differently have been a root cause of this problem?
Public schools are a shining achievement in the American process, but they're also subject to the politics of the American political process as well. And it plays a huge factor. People don't necessarily leave the biases that they hold in their private lives or the biases that they absorb through popular culture, whether they want it or not, when they go to the classroom. We even know that kids aren't immune to this. When we, you know, did studies a long time ago, when you were handing, you know, even young black kids a white doll and a black doll, some of the black kids looked at the black doll and said it was evil. And they themselves are black. So we know how much that bias can overcome all of us. And that's why we have to be actively anti-racist, you know, as individuals, as institutions, and particularly in our public school system. Teachers have to do a lot of reflecting among all of the other things that they have to do. And believe me, all of the teachers I worked with were working something like 3 full-time jobs when they were doing their work during the year. But they have to get to a point where they are able to reflect on, how does this affect my practice? How does this interaction I have right now come from the things that I've brought to the classroom as opposed to the situation that's happening in front of me? And part of that is it's not just a 30-minute training at the beginning of the year. It's active work on this. It's coaching from principals who've gotten the trauma-informed teaching and some of the racial bias training. It's working to foster a culture of compassion and empathy, because we know that when we foster a culture of compassion and empathy with kids of any color, with kids of any income, learning happens even better, right? Kids are a lot more likely to learn in a situation or an environment when they're not inherently scared or threatened all of the time. And, you know, we're not going to get out of a discussion about schools and racial bias without talking about the blue-eyed, brown-eyed kid experiment, right? And that teacher only did this over the course of a few days, but she noticed that when she put the kids, and I'm going to steal a term from Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote a couple of amazing books, but caste, when she put one of the groups in the subordinate caste, when she put them in the out group, they had a hard time concentrating. They were jumpy. Their academic performance suffered. These were kids who had not experienced the bias before in their lives, suddenly under that kind of pressure, and they were acting out. And they weren't doing the work that they were supposed to do. And they weren't behaving the way that they were supposed to behave. So we know there are very real costs to bringing all of these biases into the room in having a system in which those biases are built in. And it can affect not just that one kid right there, but families for generations afterward. One story I tell is of my own family. So my great-grandfather came here from Durango, Mexico. So my grandparents were raised in El Paso, and my mom was raised in El Paso. And my grandfather went to public school. My grandmother went to public school. They were beaten in school in El Paso for speaking in Spanish. And then my mother went to public school in the 60s. She was beaten in school for speaking in Spanish. And so although my parents and my grandparents spoke Spanish around me, they did everything they could not to speak Spanish to me, because for them, even though they didn't reject their culture at all, you know, there was no rejection of the food, there was no rejection personally of the language, they didn't want me to go to school to get beaten. And so for the rest of my life, I'm going to spend a lot of time trying to reacquire a lot of the language lost. I'm going to spend a lot of time trying to reacquire culture lost on actually both sides because of my African-American heritage and how much has been cut off on that side as well. And that all started with this enforcement of racism, this enforcement of caste in a public school in Texas, you know, long before I was alive, 80 years ago? 100 years ago, right? So we have to be aware of how much impact these systems have on this country for years hence.
You said it at the beginning, this is a multi-pronged situation, and this is a systemic problem in so many different areas. What you just shared about your family not wanting to raise you speaking Spanish fluently because they were afraid of you getting beaten brings back memories of my own family. I was born and raised in Colombia, so I obviously had to speak Spanish. But my cousins that were raised in New Jersey they don't speak and they don't understand any Spanish because they were discriminated against because their mother was Hispanic, and they didn't want to get bullied. So they couldn't communicate with my cousins that didn't speak English. So it does create a loss of culture that is heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. And while you were talking, I was just thinking about like how big this problem goes. It's not just the police departments. It's what you said about the teacher that has three different jobs. And I mean, already they have too much responsibility, too many kids in the classroom, but a lot of them have insurmountable student debt that they have to pay. So they're driving around as Uber drivers in their spare time to try to pay their bills. They're also putting some of their salaries into the school supplies so that they can teach their own kids. And the schools don't have enough to feed some of these kids that are food insecure, that are acting out because they're literally tired and hungry. And a lot of the times, people just want to throw a 30-minute or one-hour, one-day training and think that that's it. That's like me going to the gym one day and wanting to look like some model. This is perpetual work. You have to work on it every single day to stay in shape. To stay in anti-racism shape, you have to do the work continually. It's not a one-thing checkmark that you go and do like, oh, okay, I'm done. I did my training once a year.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm sorry about your family. I know that it's probably hard. When they think about that loss of language, people just think of the words, but they don't think of the relationships and that culture. And it's such a painful loss, but we have to work.
One of the saddest things was my grandma didn't, their own grandma, the shared grandma, didn't speak English and they didn't speak Spanish. So they really couldn't talk to their own grandma without a translator, without an interpreter. Like one of our aunts, their own mother, my mother, somebody explaining. And it's heartbreaking. It's like a whole relationship that is vital to people is lost because the parents at the time, they made the decision to not teach Spanish to their kids so that their kids wouldn't get beaten up in school.
Yes.
All right, well, before we get going, Candace, do you have anything you want to plug? Any social medias you want people to follow you on? Anything else you want to plug?
Well, I'm going to continue to do the work to fight the school-to-prison pipeline, among many other things right now. In Texas, we have great need with COVID-19, and we're still feeling the effects of the recent winter storm. I say recent, it was a month ago, but that loss of power, that loss of infrastructure really hurt families here. You can follow me at Candace424, that's CandaceFor24. That's the same thing on Instagram. I'm also on Facebook as well. You can look me up as Candace Valenzuela. I'm currently working with Vote Mama. I'm the Texas chair. And they're an organization devoted to getting mothers of school-age children into every level of office because we see an absence of those voices. We see an absence of informed policy about a lot of what women and families go through. And so I'm working hard on that for municipal races coming up here in May. And for anybody who's from Texas and listening, well, you're probably not going to be able to vote in the May 1st election, but think about it for next year.
And we'll include all of the links to that in our show notes so people can just visit and reach you and follow you.
I appreciate it, Sylvia.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Candace. We had a great chat.
Incredible conversation. Thank you so much.
When you were talking, you reminded me of when you were talking at the very, very beginning about the idea of catching the bigger criminals by catching the smaller ones. And I don't know if you heard about Baltimore, but the state's attorney general decided to kind of change the rules due to the pandemic. And they announced that the city was not going to be prosecuting, drug possession and these other small crimes to keep people out of jail because they needed to prevent the spread of the virus. And in fact, because they stopped doing that, violent crime in Baltimore dropped 20% over the past year from March 2020 to March 2021, which was super interesting because it's kind of proving that strategy that you spoke about at the beginning of like, oh, let's go for the little guys, it doesn't do anything. The property crime decreased, homicides decreased, and everything just went down. So they're going to actually continue and no longer prosecute drug possession, prostitution, trespassing, and other minor charges.
So the common understanding now is that broken windows policing failed. And whatever we did, that failed. But it's hard for me to say that broken windows policing failed because we didn't really do broken windows policing. Like the theory, when it was an academic theory, the theory was that if you provide proportional punishments for small crimes and like people consistently get caught for small crimes and get a proportional punishment, that it will create a sense of consequences and a sense that, oh, you're going to get caught and it's not worth it to commit crimes. But that's not what we did. We didn't do proportional punishments for small crimes. We just said, okay, we're going to throw the hammer on everyone. Do you know who Kalief Browder was?
No.
Kalief Browder was this kid in New York. I think he was like 19 or something. He was young. But he stole a backpack. And he was in prison before his trial even happened for 3 years on Rikers Island.
What?
Yeah. And I don't even know how he was in prison for so long before his trial started. But 3 years, I think it was, on Rikers Island before his trial even started. for stealing a backpack. That's the way that we implemented quote-unquote broken windows policing, but that's not what it's supposed to be. And that doesn't create a sense of consequences. That creates a sense that, well, nothing matters. My life's ruined. Doesn't matter what I do.
So what happened to him in the end?
So he got out of Rikers after 3 years, and 2 of those years he spent in solitary confinement, by the way.
Oh, my God.
And 2 years after, yeah, and 2 years after he got out of prison, he killed himself.
That's the state's responsibility. The state should be blamed for this. A kid that steals a backpack is not on track to become a hardened criminal or, you know, die by suicide, probably. I mean, the probabilities of that happening are very slim. But if you put a person, a kid, in solitary confinement for 2 years, that's not the, what do you expect?
I mean, again, that's a whole nother thing. Like, I think we pitched like 4 episodes in this episode, but solitary confinement is something we should probably just not use for anyone. Let alone for 2 years. You know, there are people who are in solitary confinement for decades sometimes. There are people.
That's insane.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, that's basically what a supermax prison is. A supermax prison is basically solitary confinement for most hours of the day through your entire sentence. Anyway, if you guys enjoyed that episode, you can be sure to leave a rating and a review if you're on a platform that allows for that. And the number one way podcast spreads through word of mouth. So share it with a friend, a family member, a coworker, all of that, and subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. Sylvia, do you want to tell us what we're going to be talking about next week?
Join us next week for a conversation with Nick Knutson from Demcast. We're going to be talking about disinformation and how all of it spreads over social media.
So definitely be sure to subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss that. And you can follow us on Instagram at TheExplanationPod, on Twitter at Explanation_pod, and on Facebook at TheExplanationPodcast.
And remember that the best way that podcasts spread is by word of mouth. So make sure you tell your spouse, your kids, your family, your mom, your aunt, your tia, abuelita, anybody you know about The Explanation. And we'll see you again next week.
See you guys next week.